So finally, we're all in agreement about what's going on with the adults.
In my opinion, there were forces inside Nissan that were against the merger of the company. Nissan old boys,
in conjunction with the saucer people, thank you,
in collusion with the prosecutor office of Tokyo,
under the supervision of the reverse vampires,
decided to arrest me to stop the merger.
In a fiendish plot to eliminate the meal of dinner. We're through the looking glass here, people.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 474 for the week of August 28th, 2023. I am Rogue Frontier Pathfinder David T. Cole, and I'm here with Decoy Guitar Sarah D. Bunting.
Play Freebird.
Best at Car Tara Ariano.
I am how you say the best at car.
And confused offspring of Japan's number one dad, Stephanie Early Green.
Him?
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a fiction writer and a friend of ours. You've heard many times with us here. It is Stephanie Early Green. Yeah! Welcome back, Stephanie.
Stephanie.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Well, we'll see if you still feel like that after we get into our lead topic. We are here to talk about Wanted, the escape of Carlos Ghosn. For over a decade, Brazilian-Lebanese-French business executive Carlos Ghosn was riding high, jumping from company to company as CEO and getting automotive operations in two different countries through economic downturns. Then, just after he started publicly making noises about the alliance between Renault and Nissan, which he was presiding over, turning into a proper merger, he got arrested in Japan for financial crimes. Oops. All four episodes of this docuseries, which were directed by James Jones, an Emmy winner for a 2015 Frontline episode about Ukraine, dropped on Apple TV Plus on Friday. I mean, I'm not going to say we're not going to spoil it because these are all true events and you can look them up on Wikipedia. I sure did because I didn't watch to the end. Spoiler for my Chen check-in answer. Let's do the Chen check-in. Stephanie, should our listeners watch Wanted, the escape of Carlos Ghosn?
Nah.
Sarah?
Nope.
Dave?
I thought the story was interesting, but it was, as all documentaries are, according to David D. Cole, too long.
Well, and yes. Sarah D. Bunting, as we heard on a recent bonus episode, but we'll get into it.
Yep.
So, Stephanie, let's start here. I'm sorry, because we love you. We know you have a busy life. We value your time. You did not deserve this. Are we forgiven, or were you very mad?
Yeah. No, I wasn't very mad, but I did watch all four episodes.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. I take my responsibility seriously as a Extra Hot Great guest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could have all been boiled down to maybe a 15-minute like interstitial.
Yeah.
It was we did not need all four episodes. Mm-mm. We did not need even three episodes.
No.
We did not need even two episodes. Like, it was too much. It was so much padding. It was structured in a really like goofy way.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Honestly, I watched all four. All of the good stuff is in the last two episodes.
Ugh. Okay.
Like, what are you doing, filmmakers?
Yeah, I take my responsibilities seriously as well. And after two episodes, I was like, if there were three, I would finish it. But there were four, and I was like, I can't. I don't care. And then when I was like, I'll just read it up on Wikipedia and see what happened, the case isn't even over. He's like still under investigation in France. It's like, what are we doing? Anyway, Sarah, as I already alluded, you already complained about this in a recent bonus episode. You are not a crackpot. Documentaries like this are too long. Proceed.
First of all, it's very Apple TV plus-y in that it looks expensive. So you think it's like super smart and like well-made, but it isn't. It could have been a feature. And actually, Stephanie's right. It should have been like a half hour YouTube video because the structuring of it is kind of designed to distract you from the fact that either they don't have access to this hard drive and they can't really say what's on it, or that there's just like the case is not disposed of yet. It's not adjudicated. So they're pushing a lot of quote, more interesting content to the back half of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then the promise of that never comes to fruition either.
Yeah.
Like just read the Wikipedia entry. We'll link it in the show notes. It's much faster and a better use of your time because it is an interesting case and it is possible to make like business, mm-hmm. true crime compelling. But this was just a lot of surface. Sometimes didn't really understand what we were expected to think was going on if we weren't second screening.
Yeah.
The structure is so bad for this story because the story is there's the CEO. We all know CEOs are generally shit people.
Yeah.
And this guy seemed to be a shit person. Mm-hmm. And what he did, you know, business-wise, seemed like everybody was in for it. The Japanese fucking loved him. He took Nissan, which was in the shitter. He turned it around like he turned around Renault in France. And he was sort of like a national hero in Japan. But it turns out he was really just a shit person, as predicted. And at a time where he was going to merge them, this is my theory, is that, I'll play it out how it played out. At the time that he decided that these companies should merge, which was sort of like never the plan publicly, suddenly he's in trouble because he cooked the books or he was like embezzling money and all this sort of stuff. My theory is Nissan didn't give a shit about that. They were fine because he brought the company up from almost bankruptcy into another success story. Mm-hmm. And they only cared about it when they were going to do this merger. So my theory is they knew about all the wrongdoing all along. Nobody is the good guy in this story. Anyways, the real crux of the story is when he decided that he was never going to get out of Japan because he was fucked, because he really did do these things. Mm-hmm. He got some ex-Green Beret to smuggle him out of the country in music tour cargo boxes.
Yeah.
And it was all cloak and dagger. That part's the interesting part.
Right.
Nothing else about this is who gives a shit? CEOs are always embezzling money, right? Like the only thing that makes this noteworthy is the size of the company and this cloak and dagger thing mixed together.
Right.
And the structure of the series is number one, the life of Carlos Ghosn.
Yeah.
By the way, this should have been called Ghosn Guy.
Yeah.
Agree.
Me wrong. So episode one, boring because it's just like a slight tease about this escape. And then it's just like, and then he actuated the mortgages of the turbines. And, you're like, and then two is the kind of the lead up to sour grapes for everybody involved, the companies, him, inconceivable guy from France who was like the head of Renault at the time. And then episode three is the actual interesting one where he escapes. And that was great. That's the one to watch. Seriously?
Yeah.
Just go watch episode three, knowing the background I just gave you.
Yeah.
And then the fourth one, after all that excitement, is just like the aftermath, which is boring and doesn't conclude because there is no conclusion. It's just him, everybody saying he's a shit, and then, you know, him being, no, I'm not. And that's the whole series. And, like, there is one quarter of it is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, agree. The escape part. And then they keep later in the series being like, oh, by the way, this Green Beret guy had already done time for blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, there's a case for, like, calling Japan to the Hague for the ways in which this Green Beret dude's kid, Green Beret Jr., was imprisoned and the conditions in solitary confinement. Is that explored? Not really. Like, the structuring of this is so, like, beyond cynically manipulative, but it doesn't work because they're not giving you substantive information in the correct order. So, but, I mean, how Apple TV Plus-y is that?
Yeah.
Very. Like, this is a very on brand, like, it's like the morning show of true crime documentaries that you're like, what am I watching? Ooh, a dolman sleeve top. Like, I get the appeal. You almost think that it's, you know, it looks prestige-y, so you're sort of lulled into being entertained by how empty it is.
Yeah.
And then after 40 minutes, you look around and you're like, I still don't know anything.
Right.
I am not as conversed in this world as you are, obviously, Sarah. But I feel like there is an inverse law relationship between how produced the footage and the chyrons and all that kind of stuff are and the substance of what they're putting all that over.
Yeah.
Especially in episode one, they are opening up all their Adobe After Effects tricks, like glitchy graphics, you know, goes from Japanese to English. The transitions are all sort of like, it's like if Winning Time was set in 2020 instead of, you know, the 80s. It's this like level of overproduced flair everywhere. It's like they're wearing all the pieces of flair. And it was just so distracting. It calms down in the second episode of it. But in the first episode, it's crazy to the point, like, when they show the title card, it says Wanted, the Escape of blah, blah, blah. And there's, like, these, like, computer game, like, glitch graphics as it goes out. It's like, what is that about? That has nothing to do with anything. What was it? Somebody's, like, keyword Japan, like, and they got, like, a pachinko machine arcade. And like, I don't know, put that in there. Let's go.
There's
like,
it was everything so... but the flashing cursor, totally. Yeah. And in the same rant where I was like, 95% of these three or four top docuseries should be 82-minute features, if that. I also was like, can we not with the let's show the empty chair of the talking head interviewee? Yeah. And then there he is and he's like, can you hear me? Is everything okay? And then someone comes with a little powder puff and daubs his eyebrow. And it's like, just cut to the fucking interview. I have shit to do. Like, watch Disappeared. Sigh.
This is bleeding into Housewives. Now they show them getting ready for the reunion. I don't need to see Ramona in the makeup chair. I just want to like... You know, I want to get to the fireworks factory.
Mm-hmm. And even when you get to the fireworks factory in episode three, they short circuit it, showing the good stuff, right? You're like, here we go. He's in the fucking music box. He's in the guitar case. They drilled hole in the bottoms. They're sneaking him onto an airplane, all this sort of stuff. And then just when it's getting to the point, they're like, but to understand this, you really need to understand Carlos Ghosn's father's time in prison from 50,000 fucking years ago.
No, you don't.
No, you don't. Just get to the fucking plane stuff.
I could hear Dave Cole screaming also that he's like, we're cutting away before we discuss toilet strat in the like roadie box. And then it's back to that. It's like, oh, by the way, this, and we're going to tell you more about it, except there won't be any more substantive information. It'll just be like, this could have been an influence. Like,
I thought it was weird that he was in the box for like 5 minutes. He was only in the box like after takeoff and then they let him out. And I'm like, what? How? And they didn't explain why that was allowed.
I feel like Taylor Swift spends more time in a box like that being wheeled around backstage so people aren't bothering her, reportedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was expecting more box content for my buck here.
Well, like Dave said, that's the only interesting part, and they know that, which is why it's the first thing you see. And then it's like, but first we need to backtrack to this guy as a teenager. Like, no, we don't. It doesn't matter.
This common detergent will kill you. News at 11. That's like 11:59 is when you're don't eat it.
Well, and my overarching question about the whole thing is like, who cares? Because other than the escape part, like I believe because all these other reputable people, when they're like, he was railroaded, like, yeah, probably, like Dave said.
All these reputable people and Richard Quest.
Yeah, exactly.
The world's most brown Englishman.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, Jesus.
But, like, the whole thing is, you know, when you're talking to reporters from the Wall Street Journal, they're going to be like, well, you know, culturally in Japan, they just don't like it when people get paid this much. Like, I also don't like it when people get paid that much. Like, you know what I mean? I don't feel sorry for this guy that, you know, he's saying, I deserved this $23 million I got paid. Like, maybe you do and maybe you don't. Not in my opinion. Like, you probably did all kinds of nefarious things. That's A. And B, when they're talking about, like, it was unheard of that he would run Nissan and Renault at the same time, these two huge companies, I was like, no offense to France, but I don't feel like running Renault is that big a job. Like, how many cars do they make in a year? 9? Like, I just don't think it's that taxing.
It's like 10 hours a week to run Renault.
Exactly.
Which is all you're getting anyway, because France. Just kidding. Lucky France. True. And it's a shame, too, because there's a whole bunch of different good story angles in here, and they couldn't pick one. Mm. And there were, like, there are two, you know, doorstop-size books that I carry at the bookshop, and nobody cares, because it's hard to marshal all of this content. Like, the guys who wrote the book that's supposed to be the superior version are on camera as interviewees in this one. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot here, like the how the Japanese criminal justice system and incarceral system stacks up against what we're used to here in the States.
Yeah.
Why certain things would be considered inappropriate culturally in France or Japan or compared to each other. What is on the fucking hard drive? What did this lawyer die of? What are the allegations? Like, the fact that Greg Kelly was just in solitary confinement and had to sit up.
Him being his Scones number two.
Because those are the rules. And couldn't have spinal surgery. And he's, like, still there for, like, 3 years. I mean, there is a lot here. But the way they put it together, it just was like, they were facing the wrong way, kind of. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, I felt like they, in order to secure the cooperation of the Gones, like they made a lot of concessions, which I think is also why, speaking of Housewives, I'm going to throw to Stephanie after this, but why we got so much content of Carol. And like, I was on all of these shows and I wrote this letter like, okay, great, I don't care. Like, that's nice. No. I would hope any wife would do that. This part of the story is not that interesting. Stop angling for Real Housewives of Paris.
No, they loved her. And it's like, she's charismatic, so we're on her side, you know? And it's like, are we though? Right. But like, the documentary doesn't take a stance on whether Gone is good or bad or kind of bad or deserve. Like, it's so muddled. I mean, they don't have a thesis. Yeah. They don't have a through line to like hang this on. So it's just every episode is all over the place, as we've already said. It's just
I think the moral compass of the Gones is revealed in the last episode, where after the Green Beret team who got him out of the country is arrested in the States because they returned to the States and now they're like been extradited to Japan and they're sitting in prison. They're like, so what do you think about that? And they're like, well, we didn't do that. The Japanese criminal system did that to them.
And they never thank them either.
Don't offer to help. They don't pay for their lawyer fees or anything like that. So they seem like perfect material for Eddie Bravo show, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
The Green Beret is going to get out eventually. And, you know, I'm sure they know people who could do things. Just saying. My favorite part of the whole show, and I texted this to my sister, who also went to French immersion as I did, was finding out the French phrase for yes men is les oui oui, which is what I'm going to be saying from now on, because that was adorable. But other than that,
that's really cute.
Oof. Take a pass on this Carlos Ghosn and his resting villain face.
Yeah.
Sinister Mr. Bean, am I wrong?
You are not.
All right, it is time to go around the dial. Our first stop, as always, with Tara.
Well, I'm thrilled that Stephanie is here this week so she can join me in discussing this, because recently I used this space to tell you what was going on with the all-queer season of The Ultimatum, which is the Netflix show about couples where one person wants to get married and the other one doesn't, so they break up temporarily to enter into fake marriages with new people in the same situation. It's back again already, except with straight couples, so it's automatically less interesting, obviously. The hilarious thing about all seasons of the show is the ultimatum giver never really thinks, they really think that they're slick and they're going to push their partner into appreciating what they have and agree to get married after going through the process. But then I feel like what more commonly happens is the person who didn't want to get married continues to not want to get married after they get the opportunity to fool around with an exciting stranger. And then the person who did want to get married is like, oh, no. And that is what happens this season with Lisa Giver and her boyfriend Brian Receiver. They are spending one last night together before deciding who they want to switch to, when she apparently wakes up in the middle of the night crying and saying she wants to go home. They don't. And she seems to spend their exploratory week being like drunk and messy and on at least one occasion smacking Brian in the face when he talks to another woman. And then at the ceremony where everyone is going to announce their new partner choices, Nick Lachey, who is unfortunately the host, says that Lisa and Brian have actually decided to leave the experiment. And I won't say why, although it has been widely reported. So if you care, you can look it up. But that leaves four couples who then basically just divide into two pairs and do like straight wife swaps with each other, which like hasn't happened before because they usually have five. And after four episodes, Sorry, I've now watched five. After five episodes, these people are also bland. I'm having a hard time remembering who everyone is. One of them, I have not even learned his name. Stephanie and I have called him Neck in our text. But
his name is James.
Thank you.
But he is Neck. He will forever be Neck.
Indeed. He has split from his girlfriend, Ryan, with two N's. They are high school sweethearts. She's never dated anyone else ever. He has, apparently. And he breaks from tradition by being the ultimatum receiver, but immediately regretting going along with all of this and turning on his new trial wife, Raya, who's like, hey, can we touch more? And he's like, I hugged you yesterday. There's
literally.
There's Roxanne, who's an entrepreneur of some kind. She's very into being a capital W working woman and uses every opportunity she gets to say that her ex Antonio is lazy and broke. And everyone else keeps telling him that she's constantly talking shit on him. And he's like, I don't believe you, no matter how many times he hears it. But she then hooks up with Alex, who seems shocked that women are able to have opinions and conversations because his ex, Kat, who's now with Antonio, is for real one of the most alarmingly blank people I've ever encountered on or off TV. Like, when we meet Alex's parents, they both say they think Roxanne will be good for him because he likes to be challenged, which I guarantee is something Kat has never done even one time and would not know how. I really hope I don't find out later in the season she's like this because of abuse or control in her past, because it will make me have to be less contemptuous. But on the other hand, I don't think I have any less respect for her than Alex himself does. Overall, I think this season's taking longer than usual to lock in for me, and I think it's because there hasn't been as much mixing and matching with the couples. But Stephanie, what do you think?
Oh, well, I have you to thank for watching this. I've binged five episodes in the last 2 days, as you know, because I've been texting you. They're all utter ding-dongs. with varying degrees of malice. I mean, that's like the only way to... I mean, you've summed them all up, but some are more hateable than others.
Of course.
And I truly hate... I hate a lot of the men.
Yeah.
James is contemptible. Alex... James, sorry, Neck.
Neck.
Alex is... So he's such a dick and he thinks he's so smart and he's not smart. He's the most basic, you know, sort of tall Patagonia wearing white dude. And but he thinks he's really something special. And the problem is, so does Kat, his girlfriend who wants to marry him. And so he has this reinforcing echo chamber telling him how awesome he is. And then he encounters Roxanne, who hates his ass. And that's actually pretty fun to watch. But Roxanne's mean to him and to her partner who she came with, Antonio, who is kind of a good for nothing. And he says that. He's like, I'm lazy. I've never been financially stable. He's not smart, but he is cute. It's fun. It's good dynamics. I'm feeling tense as we're going into episode six. I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. And I have a feeling I'm going to be displeased with how things shake out. Because I kind of want them all to break up and like be just go their separate ways. And I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't know. I feel like there's a better than zero chance that everyone is just like, we give up. <'Cause> they're all terrible matches.
Tara, did you watch the fight between Ryan and Neck?
No.
Oh, I thought that was episode five. Maybe that was episode six, where they're like, it's on the surveillance cam in their apartment and it goes until like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, I can't wait. Awesome.
It gave me anxiety, and yet I couldn't look away. So you need to get there, and then your thinking might change on these people.
Okay,
anyway.
Well, yeah. Anxiety but can't look away is the show in a nutshell. So, yeah.
Yes.
New season of The Ultimatum. Check it out. For my plug, for Cracked, I made a list of the 50 greatest sitcom pilots, and I watched so many that did not make this list. But go and check it out. We'll link it in the show notes.
All right, Stephanie. What do you have for us today?
Okay, I'm going to briefly talk about two TLC properties because I don't really have any plugs, so I feel like I'm going to use my time this way. The first is Sister Wives. Sister Wives is back, baby, and this is season 18, if you can believe it. Cody is down to two, but really only one wife out of four that he started with. So for any Sister Wife neophytes who are interested in dipping a toe into the world of the Browns, I would suggest at minimum going back to last season, season 17, because that's when the shit really hit the fan in this family. And Christine one of the wives defected, broke up with Cody, and that really sent shockwaves through the entire system. It's hard to sum up all the ups and downs of this weird family after 18 seasons, but suffice it to say that pretty much all of the problems that this family has are due to Cody being a giant asshole. I mean, he sees his wife's as servants and his children as props, and he pretty much always has, but COVID really brought out the absolute worst in Cody Brown. He refused to go to his daughter's spinal surgeries across the country because COVID. Like, he's like, oh, I can't go, COVID. He didn't have COVID. He just, COVID prevented him from getting on a plane.
Sure.
To support his child as she's undergoing, like, life-threatening surgery. He uses COVID as an excuse not to see most of his children and to only spend time with the children of his favorite wife, Robin. And those children are young enough that he can still manipulate them. But once his kids hit like the age of reason, he has no use for them anymore. So most of his kids don't talk to him at this point. It just boggles the mind that in 2023, Cody is still using COVID as a hobby horse and a reason not to like have relationships with his many, many offspring. Mm-hmm. So I'm mostly watching this season to see Janelle, who is my personal favorite housewife. Sorry, not housewife, sister wife, defect from the family.
Yes.
Although I would like to see her on Housewives, maybe Salt Lake City, I don't know. And it's just so satisfying to see this awful man get his comeuppance after so many years. The other TLC property I'd like to give a really quick shout out to is 90 Day UK, which I feel like people are sleeping on this mostly because it's just on Discovery Plus. But if you have the app and you're watching like Dr. Pimple Popper and 1,000-Pound Sisters, you know, why not check out 90 Day UK? It's a great mix of people who are even nuttier and more delusional than the Americans on 90 Day Original Flavor, if you can believe it. And then there's a couple people who are like genuinely lovely and you want to root for them. Like there's a person this season named Shane who I just want the best for, but mostly they're just insane. Their accents are insane. There's like no fluff. There's no filler. Like 90 Day Original, there's so much. They'll take a tiny plot line and milk it for like 5 episodes. In 90 Day UK, someone can like get pregnant and have a baby like the same episode. It's, I mean, it's only the essentials. It's so good. So if you have Discovery Plus, check it out. And as I said, no plugs. I'm in grad school. I'm getting my MFA in fiction. So haven't been putting a lot out there, but all of my fiction, if you care to read it, is on my website. So check it out.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Serenity Bundick.
Project Greenlight. Yes, we're talking about it again. I know the Max reboot has come up a few times on the show in recent weeks, but now that I have finally started watching it, I needed to work through a possible crackpot theory. It really is kind of striking that you have a completely different production, you have a completely different executive team, different set of mentors, legit non-window dressing, experience-based focus on diversifying the project and the talent pool. All of this has changed. It's all good. And yet, we have arrived again at another intransigently slow, stubborn, clueless director who is infuriatingly compelling television. I do not know what this says exactly, except that perhaps, I don't think I'm a crackpot, but the so-called ecosystem that is Project Greenlight, which I think is an A-minus show about the creation of C-plus films, has its own like rules and processes that are innate to it and create inevitable outcomes. Evidently, it is able to bend entirely new casts, talents, and guiding concepts to inevitabilities. Is there a Chris Moore-esque vacuum that Project Greenlight nature abhors, which then sucked Montrell McKay into it? Mm-hmm. I'm not mad about this outcome, by the way. I'm just asking questions, as they say. Director slash contempt target of the season, Miko Winbush, is charming sometimes and has a very good dog named Dash, but you could not have cooked up a more perfectly, maddeningly vague Project Greenlight director if you did it in a lab. Like, literally everything out of her mouth is some variation on, well, so, you know, that's where that is. And yeah, I get it. But the thing is, you know, it's kind of a situation where, I don't know. Yeah. Like, this is every talking head. This is every scene that she's in. this is a writer director. This is why they picked her. Like, it, I mean, it got messy almost immediately. I love it. I'm rationing episodes because this drama is extremely my shit, and I am fully expecting this to transition into a true crime documentary when one of the executive producers kills someone.
Yeah.
And that's my segue into my plug. You can read reviews of Not Wanted, colon, etc., but various other Carlos Ghosn properties and various other unsuccessful properties at my True Crime Review newsletter. It's out every weekday. I write it with Eve Beatty. It's called Best Evidence, and you can find it at bestevidence.fyi.
All right, here is what's coming up on the Extra Hot Great Extended Cinematic Universe. This Friday on Extra, Extra Hot Great, we are going to watch Archer again after many, many seasons off. It is in its final season, so we thought we'd check back with that show. And then bonus, Extra, Extra Hot Great, sometime between that Friday and the next Friday, we're going to drop the third of three of these with Mockomania, concluding with a look at the pilot TV movie of The Streets of San Francisco. Go to the Extra Hot Great Club page at extrahotgreat.com/guesswhatclub and sign up today. And then right here on EHG Prime next week, it's TV Boss Thunderdome. 27 TV bosses enter Thunderdomes. Mortal combat ensues. Only one will emerge victorious. Who will it be? Only one way to find out. Listen. Yeah.
Yes.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
Over the two-part series premiere of the new Star Wars show, Ahsoka,
yep,
a character named Sabine, who has been resisting the idea to this point, finally gets over herself and commits to start Jedi training as Ahsoka's Padawan. And the way this is conveyed to us visually is some bullshit. I am not a crackpot, but Ahsoka could credibly give Sabine a character moment or a tidy haircut, not both. What happens is Sabine, alone in the space lighthouse she's been living in, gathers up her long hair into a loose ponytail in one hand. With the other, she takes a knife and hacks that hair off with one stroke. So first of all, bad move. She has dyed her hair in like half a rainbow's worth of colors. It's past her shoulders. It's very cute on her. Suits her face shape. She's obviously played by a beautiful actress and can carry off both hairstyles, but losing that length is a downgrade, in my opinion. But second, hair does not cut like that. I don't care how long or short or thin your hair is. We all know this instinctively. Even with scissors, it takes a few attempts to get all the way through a ponytail. With a knife, no, it's not how knives work. Third, when we see Sabine's hair after, she looks like a boy in the 70s. It's parted on one side. It's like swept across her forehead, longish sides. I can hear your next question. It's all fucked up in the back, right? Because she cut it herself with a knife. Great question. No, of course, it's not fucked up in the back. It looks like she went to a salon in Beverly Hills and spent $300 to get it cut with a razor. It's perfectly shaped. It's graduated. It doesn't in any way match up with what we saw happen on screen. And I understand why the decision was made to play it out as we saw. Sabine is showing she is serious. She's giving up frivolous concerns like personal aesthetics. She's embracing efficiency instead. She's being, you know, not feminine. But if that's what we're supposed to discern about the character, the show's creators should have had the courage to go all the way with it. If she doesn't care enough about her hair to cut it properly, she shouldn't care what it looks like at all, particularly in the back. Let it be shaggy with a hole in the middle until it grows out. And if the show's creators did not want to commit to keeping Sabine's hair authentically weird in the back, there was an easy way around it. Don't show her cutting it. Just let her show up with short hair in the next scene. We would figure out why she had made the change, and we could imagine she went to Fantastic Space Sam's to get someone to do it with scissors or a space razor. It wouldn't have made her any less of a badass. Half of being a badass is knowing which tasks to delegate, like cutting your hair. I am not a crackpot.
Wow. I am confident that content we just heard is unavailable anywhere else on the internet. It is time once again for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week, it is Jeff. Take it away, Jeff.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. This is Jeff, and I'm submitting Please Like Me, Season 3, Episode 4, Natural Spring Water for the canon. Please Like Me is an Australian series from the mid-2010s following a group of aimless friends in their early 20s. Central to the show are Josh, played by series creator Josh Thomas, and his best friend and roommate Tom. Josh comes out in the first episode of the series, which is shortly followed by his mother Rose attempting suicide. The first two seasons cover her recovery and eventual stay in a psychiatric hospital, alongside Josh exploring his sexuality with much awkwardness, navigating friendship with his ex-girlfriend Claire, and trying to keep the peace between his divorced parents and his dad's new girlfriend. All the while, the perpetually unlucky in love Tom continues to stumble his way through. After a short and stellar first season and a very uneven second season full of new characters and arcs that didn't always work, we start season 3 with Josh agreeing to pursue a real relationship with Arnold, a fellow patient of his mother's whom he met at the end of the second season. Arnold lives with severe anxiety, and the season ended with him telling Josh they could only be friends due to his commitment issues. The first few episodes of season 3 center on their blossoming relationship, including helping Arnold come out to his parents and feel more secure in Josh's love for him. Which brings us to episode 4, opening with the boys, Josh, Arnold, and Tom, taking Molly preparing for a night of adventure. This naturally spikes Arnold's anxiety, with Josh and Tom alternately trying to help him calm down and taking shots at each other.
Will you guys think I'm not cool if I don't do it?
I don't think there's any chance of anyone in this room being cooler than anyone else in this room.
Well, whatever, you know you're the coolest one in the group.
What? No, I'm not.
No, I didn't actually think that. I just wanted to see if you would agree if I said it out loud.
Okay, I can do this. We're young, we're hot.
You think we're hot?
You've got your whole life ahead of you to get back on track.
This whole scene is a great example of this show's lived-in feeling friendships, with constant button-pushing backed by a clearly deep affection. Following the opening credits, we find the boys extremely high. Tom decides he's bonded with Josh's dad, Alan, who's dealing with some relationship problems, and gives him a quick call. That'll become relevant later. After that, it's time to hit the club. At the club, the boys are quickly approached by Ella, a stranger who's out with work colleagues she doesn't much like. Ella's suggestion that their next adventure should be to go for a run doesn't quite work out as planned. Tom faceplants, and now it's off to the hospital.
Oh, no,
okay,
Josh!
That's Tom!
Oh, no, Tom! Did you hit your head?
Yeah.
Okay. We should call an ambulance because a guy that I knew hit his head once and he thought it was nothing, and then his brain swelled and he died.
Oh no.
He wasn't very likable.
Also, we should call an ambulance because Tom's arm is not going the right way.
Oh, Ned.
How did you fall?
I don't know. The ground was there and then it wasn't there anymore.
Did it look cool?
It looked like a giraffe being tranquilized.
While waiting for news on Tom, Ella interrogates Josh and Arnold about their relationship as only an outsider can, exposing that they're maybe not completely on the same page.
So, we've established that Arnold is the smartest.
Did we establish he was the smartest?
Yeah.
Femtoseconds? It's nonsense.
Who is the kindest?
Well, it's Arnold, isn't it?
Who'd be most likely to fetch water if you're hungover?
Yes, yes, Arnold.
Which one of you would be in charge after a plane crash?
Oh, that's Josh. Me, I would just love to take charge after a plane crash. I mean, that is the dream.
Are you two monogamous?
Yes.
We haven't discussed it yet.
Ooh, tension.
Oh, no. No tension. We just have not discussed it yet.
Can we discuss it now?
No.
No.
Nope.
No.
This conversation also brings up Ella's failing relationship, and now we get a wonderful scene mirroring the relationships of the younger and older characters. Alan's girlfriend May has called Josh, so Alan calls Tom because they've bonded, and we cross-cut between Ella talking with Arnold about her heartbreak alongside the two calls.
We had a good relationship, but this is not my life. This is his life.
Yeah, I understand.
Why don't I know what's good for me? I should be the foremost expert on what's good for me, but I'm not.
I just feel like a fool. You know, I don't know how I ever let myself believe it. I could make her happy.
You did make her happy. Then she changed into someone that you couldn't make happy.
Tom spills the beans that they're at the hospital and that they were high, and Alan goes straight into dad mode, showing up to scold Josh and Tom, who hilariously become children again in the face of Alan's over-the-top rant. He remains one of my all-time favorite TV dads, wanting to be stern with Josh and have him take responsibility, but fated to be goofy. Anyhow, everyone eventually calms down, Alan takes them home, cue credits. Please Like Me is a show I've been wanting to submit to the canon for a while, but to be honest, I just couldn't settle on an episode. I consider the first 6 episodes of season 3 to be a near-perfect run of television, and any one of them on its own doesn't give you all of the highs, lows, and hilarity this show has to offer. I've watched this run more times than I can count, and it never ceases to make me laugh, cry, and cringe. But I must submit one, so I'll present my case in a series of arguments that outline why this is a canon-worthy episode of TV and the one from Please Like Me that should be the one, and maybe just the first, to join the ranks. Number 1, the introduction. As you've previously discussed, introducing a new character in the middle of a series is hard. Please Like Me itself has struggled to do it, but Ella's entrance is flawless. She has immediate chemistry with everyone, the use of the hospital trip as a way for the characters to talk and bond is ingenious, and by the end of the episode, she feels like a natural part of the group. She'll go on to become one of my all-time favorite TV characters. Number 2. One Crazy Night episodes are generally some of the best, with the chance to see characters you love bumping up against new people and situations in quasi-real time. But it's not just about the antics. This episode brings in a new character, deepens the Josh and Arnold relationship, and furthers Alan's arc, all in a very economical way. Number 3, the use of music. Please Like Me has an exceedingly charming score, and its use of music is always playful and thoughtful. In fact, it features probably the best example of music specifically scored to the beats of a scene since the Seinfeld openers. In addition, one of the most fun flourishes of the series is the opening credits, where in some episodes it's clear the characters are listening to the opening song and dancing or singing along, and in others like this one, it's simply over a montage. You also have the way Loverboy transitions seamlessly from the record player in the house to the club remix, and the way Backstreet's Back cuts out instantly upon Tom's fall never fails to make me laugh. Every cue is meticulously thought through and keeps the momentum moving forward. Number 4. This show has always been best when it focuses on the antics of Josh, Tom, and the gang, and sometimes struggled to get B-plots off the ground. The side characters are fun, but as with Alan in this episode, they generally work best when interacting with the main crew versus in their own storylines. While I would love to see Rose, Claire, and a pre-Nanette Hannah Gadsby in a canon episode, I still feel like this is the right one to make a case for. Number 5. Boys Kissing. Throughout the series, Josh Thomas clearly writes and casts the show to give him ample opportunities to kiss cute boys, which, who among us? It's also the first time I related to a representation of gay relationships on screen because I'm also an awkward mess. I'll just say that Looking wishes it had what Please Like Me has. Number 6. Lastly, this episode is a great showcase for Please Like Me's ability to swing between sentimentality and acidity, never letting either take over for too long. It covered real issues, saw couples through breakups and makeups, and always took everything the characters faced seriously. But there were never any very special episodes because the humor and agonies of life were always right where they should be, right next to each other. With all that said, I humbly present Please Like Me, Season 3, Episode 4, Natural Spring Water for the Extra Hot Great Canon. But seriously, watch the first 6 of the 3rd season over and over.
Jeff, thank you so much. Stephanie, you chose this from our submissions. Please start us off.
I have actually talked about this show before on Extra Hot Great episode 306. I looked back and checked. I watched the whole, all 3 seasons straight through, but it was 3 years ago. So I was trying to remember if I recalled this episode in particular. And actually, this is not one of the ones that stuck with me, which could be a mark against it. I'm not sure. It's hard. Like, I relate to the struggle of the submitter because it is hard to pick one Please Like Me episode. They're short. And this is like a series that has one long arc of Josh, his friends, his family with, like, you know, side plots, but it's basically one long thing. And I won't spoil how it begins and ends, but once you've watched the whole series, it kind of makes sense. So it is hard to pluck one episode out because it's not going to contain the multitudes that you'd need it to. But here are my thoughts. I love that he mentioned the music because I am obsessed with this theme song. I talked about it last time on this very program that it's so catchy. It sticks in your head. You have to dance to it. I particularly love the episodes where the characters are, for example, chopping, like cooking to the music, singing to it, dancing. I love it. And it just puts me in the mood to watch the episode. The Backstreet Boys scene where Tom eats it as they're running and the music cuts out is so hilarious. I've watched it like 3 times in a row. I love it so much. It's such a great use of that music. It is really smart the way this show uses music. So I agree with Jeff. Other things, I really, really love the relationship between Alan and Tom. Alan is a great dad character. He's complex. He's flawed, but he means well. He's wonderful. And I love that they're going into this side relationship of Josh is the main character, but his dad knows his best friend. His dad has a relationship with his best friend. And I think that mirrors real life. And I don't often think you see that in television, like a relationship between a friend and a friend's dad. Back to Alan. Alan's meltdown at the end really clinches this episode for me. It's so good. His like hurt when he realizes that Tom was on drugs, on MDMA the whole time they were chatting. And he just is mad and hurt. But then he like pulls himself together and drives them anyway because he's the dad and he's going to drive them home. I love about Alan that he doesn't exist solely in service to Josh as a character. He has his own arc. I'm talking about this like a fiction writer, but he, as a side character, you need side characters to have their own interests, arcs, development, change. And Alan is one of those characters where you watch what he goes through with May and his relationship with Josh's mother, his relationship with Josh, his relationship with Josh and his friends. It's really well done. One knock on this episode that I didn't totally agree with Jeff about the parallel structure between Ella's relationship struggles and May and Alan's struggles. I don't think that totally worked for me because we're not invested in Ella yet. I don't really care about her ex and her boyfriend and whatever. I felt like that was a bit on the nose having the two mirrored, like they're both going through breakups. Okay, but like I care about Alan and May a lot more than I care about Ella at this point. And maybe I thought that was a bit heavy-handed, to be honest. I didn't love that. Overall, laughed, enjoyed, mix of poignancy and humor, which is what I look for in a Please Like Me episode. I did check the boxes, but I've seen the whole series and I don't know if this is like one of the ones I put in the canon just because I didn't remember it. So I'm kind of hung up on that. I'm going to wait to see what you guys say and then I'll decide.
Okay, I'll go next. First, a correction. There were 4 seasons of this show, not 3.
Oh, well, I've watched all of them.
I believe you. I'm just saying in case anyone is looking for them. There are 4, not 3. This was a show that Dave and I watched for a time, and then we fell off. Dave is squinting.
I don't remember that at all.
Well, there's a lot of things you don't remember.
That's true.
So we were not still watching it at this point in its run. So I was happy to revisit it. I can't remember what made us stop. What I was struck by in this episode is something that Jeff didn't even talk about, really, is that it's a different, we've talked in other episodes about how annoying a drug trip episode can be. And what I enjoyed about this one is that it doesn't show us the trip from the inside. It shows all of these characters from the outside being annoying, which is so like, good. What happens, you know? And so I thought that was a very clever turn on it. It's we happened to watch this the same day or the same weekend as the last episode of Minx also had an MDMA trip where we see in one of the moments where a character doing extremely elaborate makeup on another one, and then it cuts out of their sort of reverie together to show them how their makeup actually looks. And it's, you know, a complete mess, like total shit show because, you know, the perfect makeup was their fantasy. Anyway, I appreciate that this was Jeff's point about this being a one crazy night episode, and it does go through a lot of phases. I thought the introduction of Ella was handled very well, and that her sort of trying to suss out who everyone is in the friend group by like asking what all the superlatives are was very clever. They're also really cute and funny in the ambulance with Evan, the hot EMT that's like feels awkward about everyone objectifying him, but also kind of doesn't really mind. I assume there's more of him and Ella, but even if there isn't, that's fine. In terms of all the, you know, vicissitudes of all the like backstory that we don't know because we haven't watched the rest of the series, Stephanie, I definitely take your point that this is like not necessarily a low point in the run, but it's like for you a flat line, and that there are other episodes that you felt were more striking. I feel like that's important context. But I was happy to enjoy this episode, and I thought there was a lot to like about it. Sarah.
I also enjoyed this episode. And just to note that this presentation was excellent, extremely organized and structured in a way that our lead topic was not. So please go make a documentary, get it in under 90 minutes. We'll be waiting. There was really a lot to like about this. I wrote down a lot of lines of dialogue. The music was outstanding. The number of tight ropes that this stays up on, like my notes say, is this too close to how boring and self-absorbed people on E are? Maybe, but it's super accurate. And also stays up on that tightrope. Like, there's a line between sentiment and treacle that I think it stays on the right side of. This friendship between and among the characters that you start out with, it feels lived in and real. Arnold's anxiety and the way that he's teased about it in a way that's like, well, you know, it's serious, but they also know that that's just a part of who he is and they know how to handle it, kind of, although they may not agree on how to handle it. The other two are sort of like, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, how elastic is Josh's face? It's like, I mean, it's really good. It's good stuff. And then there are these moments that are heartfelt, but like not so, it's not like TV heartfelt TM. It's like, you know, Alan being insecure about hearing May's laughter and then you're like, why is she laughing? It's like, I don't know, maybe she farted. Like, I mean, there's a lot in here that really feels observed and not in a like academic or performative way. Like, these people just feel very real. But with that said, like, they're tripping balls, and that was a little annoying and tiresome after a while. Like, you know, I've been on both sides of that, and like, I get it, but how documentary do we need to be about that part? And I wasn't necessarily compelled to keep watching. So I am not sure how I'm going to vote with this, but I want to say that the presentation was outstanding, and I thought maybe Stephanie would help me clarify my thoughts, but I think we're all kind of at the same crossroads. So, Dave, tell us how to think.
Oh, finally it's happening. Tell us how to think. I enjoyed this episode a lot. I'm so glad, Stephanie, you said the thing about, you know, the relationship sort of diptych not quite working, a little heavy-handed, because I did think that. I usually think that, though, about, like, writers being writers sometimes, that they tend to get a little Sorkin-esque sometimes with the let me show you how smart I am stuff. Not that I thought this was particularly egregious. I was like, it's a little much. But otherwise, I really enjoyed the episode. Having watched this episode in season 3, if you haven't seen it, I would describe it as if the adults were real people and the show was more grounded, you can insert an in-betweeners comparison here. Like, it felt like a grounded in-betweeners where the adults were actually not caricatures there to make just wacky things happen. On that note, I really enjoyed the dynamics of everybody. I'm really happy to hear that Ella is a main character in this season, because I instantly loved that character. I thought she was great. That sort of person in real life would scare the shit out of me, being so forward and asking questions about you 20 minutes after meeting you for the first time. I would be like running for the hills. Oh no, confidence, bye. But in the context of this TV show and streamlining and accelerating her insertion into the social group, I thought it worked really well, and it didn't feel forced in the way that, you know, this diptych of relationship camera work and telephone calls and stuff did. So overall, I was very pleased with this episode. I laughed a lot, and Tara is right about the drug stuff. Seeing just how annoying it is was fun for a change. You know, I didn't need the looking at your hand in first person perspective as it waves around. Seen that a lot. So it's kind of nice to see just these like dicks on drugs doing dicky things for a bit. And I didn't feel like it didn't feel to me overwhelming, like that was all the episode was about. But it felt like a catalyst for some of the stuff that happens, and that was fine. Like, them dancing, like, really raving in the club, and then, like, the pan back when you realize that, they're there really early and nobody else is there. It was really funny and a great character note.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff I really enjoyed. It's light, for the most part, and it did remind me of In-Betweeners in a good way, without being a copy of it. But it did give me those vibes. All right, let's put this to the official vote, because I feel like this is going to be an interesting one. Stephanie, having heard everything, has some time to make up your mind. What say you? Canon worthy or not?
You want to say yes.
Okay, Stephanie is convinced by Dave Cole's brainwaves. Tara?
I'm going to say yes as well. It did make me want to revisit the show.
Sarah D. Bunting?
You did it, Dave.
All right.
It's a yes for me.
Yeah, Dave Cole, champion of Please Like Me, a show he's never seen before, but he has. That makes it official. It's a sweep. Which means, Please Like Me, Series 3, Episode 4, Natural Spring Water, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Camp.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to discover the winner and loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I certainly do. It's Drea Di Matteo, who has created the first Sopranos alum OnlyFans account and called it the Sopornos. And what is there not to like about this? Oh, right. The strike that necessitated this happening, probably. But I feel like the world is net a better place for its existence.
Can I ask what she's doing on this account?
Nudes.
It's an OnlyFans, so... She's doing things with less clothes on than at her regular job.
All right. And we lost him, but I guess Polly Walnuts isn't going to be on there. Right? That would be great. And loser of the week?
I mean, all of us, because there can't be an OnlyFans account called Polly's Walnuts. Yeah. But also, Doogie Kamealoha, MD, tragically canceled after 2 seasons at Disney Plus. I'm sure this was not a cheap show to make because they shot in real ass Hawaii, but still... Sad, sad news. It was a really cute show. I liked it a lot. And, you know, given how Disney Plus has been yanking stuff off, I guess go hurry up and watch them because they might not be there for long.
Speaking about yanking stuff off, you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Oh, game time.
And speaking about OnlyFans Sopranos, you know what time it is? Welcome back to Game Time. This is the seventh game of our current season. Our scores are Tara with 3, Sarah with 2, Value Guests with 1. Today we're playing I Do or Maybe I Don't from Meredith, who earns themselves an extra credit topic of their choosing, plus a free shirt from the store at throughmethods.com, as does Jeff for the canon. So get those submissions in. You can get yourself some extra credit topics, some free swag. All good. All right, Meredith writes, it's wedding season, apparently, and there's no better wedding than a TV wedding. Sometimes the knot is tied and sometimes it isn't. Either way, the road to the altar is rarely smooth. I will describe a memorable TV wedding. You will get a point for identifying the couple as a whole and a point for the name of the show. So if you need a hint, you can ask for the couple, then name the show. Here's an example. A destination wedding with its share of complications. The fathers of the bride and groom squabble over the bill, and the venue is in worse shape than the bride remembers. And then there's that pesky detail of the groom saying the wrong name during his vows. So the couple is...
Ross and Emily.
Yes, from...
Friends.
Friends, yes. That would be a 2-point answer. That is how you play it. Steel meal situation, please start, Ariane.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has 1. I have 3. Valued guests have Eric's meal for 1.
And somebody has a Mindy weather call, as I recall.
Me.
Yes. I am here to tell you, you cannot use it today.
Okay.
It's only applicable in certain circumstances, but I want you always to be thinking about it.
Okay.
When will it come into play? What is it? How do I use it? And what will happen? These are all questions to be answered in the future.
Another time. Yeah.
Let's throw it to Pinky and see who's going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Stephanie is our order today. 27 questions, 1 gross worth equalizer challenge zone right in the middle of all things. Are we ready to play I Do or Maybe I Don't?
Yes.
All right. Tara, here is your wedding description. After preparations for the big day, the couple decide they don't want to wait, so they get married in the town square in the middle of the night. Couple and show. If you don't know anything, you can ask for the couple, then name the show.
I'll take the couple, please.
That is Luke and Lorelai.
Oh, Gilmore Girls.
Gilmore Girls, good for just 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
During the post-wedding celebration, the groom overhears the bride say that she faked her pregnancy. He picks up a gun and shoots her. She falls overboard.
Oh, God. I mean... There's so many that this could be, sadly. Could I get the couple, please?
Emily and Daniel.
Emily and Daniel. oh, revenge?
Revenge is good for 1 point as well.
Oh, remember that thing?
Yeah.
Stephanie. Due to bad weather, the officiant slash haikuist cancels and the outdoor ceremony is moved to the community center. The mother of one of the grooms in full papal regalia performs the ceremony and his sister in a bridal gown walks him down the aisle.
I'm going to need the couple.
David and Patrick.
Oh, Schitt's Creek?
Schitt's Creek. All right, everybody has 1 point. No full answers yet. Let's go back to Tara to see how she does. Even though they are related, these two characters have real feelings for each other. They are dismayed to discover that their fake wedding ceremony was actually real.
I think this is maybe in George Michael on Arrested Development.
That is correct for 2 points.
Oh, wow, nice. Yes.
To Sarah D. Bunting. In order to get a couple more days off for the honeymoon, the groom decides to work a shift on his wedding day. He gets out of work late and goes to the wrong church. Though, through a twist of fate, they get hitched by the end of the episode.
I need the couple again, please.
The couple is Carla and Turk. Continuing the trend
Scrubs.
Of Sarah D. Bunting somehow getting the Scrubs questions.
Yeah, why?
All right, back to our value guess. In the series' final episode, the couple announced their engagement, and all of their friends rushed to give them the perfect wedding. Loose ends are tied up, and the ceremony basically goes off without a hitch.
Couple, please.
Donna and David.
Oh, question. Picky.
You probably should have went to somebody else, but you got it.
I guess Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah, that's good for one. Back to Tara. In the series pilot episode, the couple stands at the altar. A man on rollerblades interrupts the ceremony to declare his love for the bride. She runs away with him to the groom's horror.
That's Alex and Dave on Happy Endings?
Okay. Yes, that is correct.
He was very boring.
He was the worst one.
He was.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Just weeks away from giving birth, the bride proposes to the groom. Their plans to elope are derailed when the bride realizes she can't get married without her parents being present. The couple tie the knot in their living room, surrounded by family.
Could I have the couple, please?
Haley and Dylan.
Haley and Dylan?
H-A-L-E-Y.
I don't know. One Tree Hill? I don't know.
That's incorrect. What I would have
said. That is...
I think I know it.
Oh!
Do you want to steal it?
Can I try? I might not know it.
Wait,
but
first,
is it the
first,
secret...
Wait, hang on. You gotta yell steel meal to make it official.
Steel meal.
Okay. What do you think that show is?
The Secret Life of the American Teenager?
No, it's not.
Oh.
It's Modern Family. Modern Family.
Oh, right.
That thing.
That All right. Alien.
But you can pick up some points here, Stephanie.
Sorry, I wasted that steel meal. Other guests.
It regenerates every
Oh,
episode.
Good.
You get a free one every week, so you might as well use that one, I say.
Yeah.
Not all goes smoothly during this destination wedding. The groom accidentally reveals the bride's pregnancy to all the guests, including the bride's very old-fashioned grandmother.
Couple, please.
Jim and Pam.
Oh, The Office.
That is The Office, yes. Tara.
Yes.
On his wedding day, the groom gets on a plane to convince the mother of the bride to attend the ceremony, but she's already there. He never makes it back. The couple's friends plan a more intimate celebration when he is able to return.
No idea. Couple. Mm.
The couple is Cece and Schmidt.
Oh, New Girl.
New Girl, yes. Sarah D. Bunting. So, a couple characters get married and everyone at the wedding is slaughtered. Or many of them are. I'm not sure. I bailed on the series halfway through the first episode. According to Meredith. So good luck on the couple name, but I think you got a good chance at the show.
Yeah, I don't know the couple name, so why don't you just give me that hint and then I'll answer.
Ed Muir and Rosalind.
Yeah, not a chance in hell. However, I believe the television program is Game of Thrones.
Yeah, sure. Of course, the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Value guest Stephanie Early Green, the backyard wedding turns chaotic when the groom's children's dog chases the bride's children's cat. Sounds wacky.
It sure does. Couple, please.
Mike and Carol.
Oh, the Brady Bunch?
That is the Brady Bunch, yes.
Both pets were killed for their role in this contretemps. Never seen again.
Tara.
Yes.
The big cake day has finally arrived. The ring bearer has chicken pox. The cake hasn't arrived. The bride's veil is dirty. And a bomb threat is made against the wedding venue. Fortunately, the whole gang pitches in to make sure the happy couple make it to the altar.
That's Amy and Jake on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That is worth 2 points. Yes. Sarah D. Bunting. The bride just wanted a small wedding, but when her mother and the groom's mother get involved, things get out of hand. On the day of the wedding, she accidentally washes the vows she has written on her hand. In the end, the groom leaves her at the altar.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty exciting, but I don't know who it is. Couple, please.
Christina and Preston. Well, I can give you the full hint here. I don't really know what this means if there's two Prestons on this show, but it says Christina and Preston, brackets, Burke. I don't know if that's a nickname or a last name.
That's how he was known. It's like Turk.
Okay.
Oh.
I don't know. Grey's Anatomy?
Yes! All right, last one before a score break for Stephanie. The bride miscarries the day before the wedding, but the couple decide to go ahead with the ceremony. Yay!
Jeez. Couple, please.
Brenda and Nate. Miscarriage, wedding, medic.
Stephanie's really getting all of Sarah's questions, by the way.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Well, can the same show come up twice?
No. This is not a repeat answer so far. This is a new show.
Brenda. Brenda. I actually don't know this one, so.
No. Okay, you take a stab. You might Grey's Anatomy it.
I don't know. Sorry.
I'll call you on time. Anybody want to take that for a steel meal? No? 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 All right.
Not going to spend a steel meal on it. Yeah, 6 feet under.
6 feet under is correct. All right, let's get the scores. We're over halfway done.
Okay, Stephanie and Sarah are tied with 4 points each. I have 8.
All right, so that means Stephanie, Sarah, you're going to share the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge.
Ooh!
All right, so the first decision you have to make together is which box you want to choose from. There are many. There is the original 80s TV expansion pack for Trivial Pursuit. There is a bespoke 90s edition. There is a bespoke 80s themed edition. There is the Pop Culture 2 box and the off-brand TV trivia box.
Whoa.
I will let Stephanie choose.
All right.
Let's do Stephanie. 90s.
90.
Let's go for it.
All right, let's do it.
But the extra little bit of knowledge you get by choosing the 90s box is each card is about 1 year. So I'll always read you the year as
well.
All
right. Okay.
And how many points do they get if they are successful?
We're going to give you two or four. Two if you get three, four if you sweep the card.
Good luck.
Thank you.
What did Kramer dub the dreaded apparatus, Wet and Wild, and the Big E on Seinfeld? What did Kramer dub the dreaded apparatus, Wet and Wild, and the Big E on Seinfeld? What was he describing?
It's a lot of data.
And this is 1993. Yeah.
It's not Elaine.
I mean, I'm fine with it. I don't know what else it could be.
The question would be who did, I believe, if the answer was Elaine, just to not make it throw
elevator? Away. I'm trying to think of something that would start with an E.
Wet and Wild.
I got nothing.
Nothing here? Sarah?
Enema.
An enema. Yes, an enema is the answer there.
All right.
Block that out, I guess.
What underwater TV series from 1993 featured Darwin, a dolphin who could converse in English with the help of the ship's computer?
I don't know. Seagate 2020. I don't even know if that's a show.
Very, very
so close.
SeaQuest DSV.
Oh, SeaQuest.
Oh, that
I vaguely remember that.
1990, what news magazine was scheduled for 5 primetime hours every week by 1999?
Dateline? I don't know. What do you think, Sarah?
I feel like that was the era when, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was on every night. And yeah, I don't remember. Your call. Which one we use?
Dateline versus 60 Minutes? Is that what the two contenders are?
Yeah, I think of those two, it would probably be Dateline, right?
Yeah, let's say Dateline.
2020.
Dateline is correct.
Yay. All right,
three questions left. You need two to get some points.
Okay.
What former writer of The Simpsons was tapped to host a network late night talk show? 1993.
It's not Conan, is it?
I think it... Yeah, it has to be, right? It's got to be Conan. Yeah.
You are correct. Need one of these last two. 1992. What type of oil filled the prosthetic breasts that Saturday Night Live's Kevin Nealon suggested naming implanters?
Peanut oil?
Yes, peanut oil is correct.
Makes sense.
Also, shut up, Kevin Nealon. Fuck.
All that work,
know, and
you
joke.
Got 1 point each. Congratulations.
Yay.
Good job.
Oh,
all right,
yay,
let's get
us
back into the weddings.
Wait,
I do.
You said two and four.
Yeah, and they got 2 points, so they each get a point.
Oh, okay.
Back to Tara.
Sorry.
Remind you, we're describing weddings. The bribe?
The bribe. Mm-hmm.
The bride pops the question over beers, and the couple weds in a garden ceremony. The bride wears red because no white, no ivory, nothing that says virgin, I have a child.
I feel like I know this, but I can't pull it. Give me the couple.
Miranda and Steve.
Sex and the City.
Sex and the City is correct. This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Oh, the Spread Eagle.
For Sarah D. Bunting, the bride's ex-boyfriend is desperately trying to win her back. The harpist goes into labor and the veil is ruined. To top it all off, the groom is having the worst hair day ever. Despite it all, the happy couple pull off the wedding with the help of their friends.
That could be anything. Couple, please.
Lily and Marshall.
How I Met Your Mother?
Yes, How I Met Your Mother. Good for one. Back to Stephanie. The couple finally wed in the series finale, and it ends with a big reveal. The voice narrating their story is that of their son, all grown up.
Kevin and Winnie?
Nope. Yeah, I gotta take a blind stab at the show now.
Sorry. I don't know.
Anybody want to take a crack at that one? It's a show you watch, Tara.
Mm.
It's Jane the Virgin.
Oh, of course it is.
Oh.
All right, this
I
is...
I watched that too.
Question. We are back to Tara. The couple invites their friends over for a party. Surprise, they're actually getting married. The show's main character tries to stop the wedding because the couple has only been dating for a month.
Couple.
April and Andy.
Parks and Recreation.
That's good for one to Sarah. The couple's big day is a happy one till the bride's father suffers a heart attack.
Couple.
David and Darlene.
Roseanne?
Roseanne, yes. Good for one. Back to Stephanie. The day of the wedding, the groom does some soul searching and decides to become a priest. After almost jumping off a cliff in her wedding dress, the jilted bride vows revenge.
Couple.
Rebecca and Josh.
Oh, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yes, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Good for nice. One. Everybody has two questions left. This one's for Tara. The father of the bride would gladly kill the groom if he found out the couple had premarital sex. The minister dies of a heart attack and his replacement hates weddings. Meanwhile, Dobermans attack everyone who walks past.
Couple.
Woody and Kelly.
Oh, cheers.
Cheers. Good for one. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
The groom decides he needs one more adventure before tying the knot. He decides to go skydiving and get stuck in a tree. He eventually frees himself, lands in a tomato truck, then gets thrown in jail. The bride bails them out, and they live happily ever after.
Couple.
Becky and Jesse.
I just don't know the answer to this.
All right, up for grabs if anybody wants to steel mill it. That is Full House. Full House.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Stephanie.
The tomato truck.
The wedding. Tomato truck. The wedding is a happy occasion, but the widow of a dastardly villain blames the couple for her husband's death and puts a curse on them.
Couple.
Luke and Laura.
I'm going to say, is that General Hospital?
It is General Hospital, yes. All right, everybody's got one question left, so let's get the scores.
Stephanie and Sarah are tied again with 7 points each. I have 11.
All right, let's get back to it. Everybody's last question. Tara? The wedding is thrown into turmoil when an old man appears claiming to be the groom's future self. He whisks the groom away and shows him a glimpse of his miserable future. The groom calls off the wedding.
Oh, man. That sounds so familiar, but I need the couple.
Anya and Xander.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sarah, your last question. This wedding's notable for who ends up officiating, the star of a major sci-fi movie trilogy.
I feel like I might know the show, but I don't know who was getting married because I don't like the show. So, couple?
Yep. Sheldon and Amy.
The Big Bang Theory.
That is correct. And our last question for Stephanie. When the bride learns that the groom is the father to a little boy, she calls off the wedding, unsure if she can be a mother. After a less than happy reunion with her own father, the bride comes to appreciate the good life she has, and the couple weds.
Couple.
Angel and Pappy.
Angel and Pappy. How's that spelled?
You know, like angle, but you switch the last two letters around.
No, I meant Pappy.
Yeah, I know you did. P-A-P-I.
P-A-P-I.
Calling you on that one. Tara, you know this one?
No.
No, it's Pose.
Oh, yes.
Oh, right.
That is regulation. Tara, let's get the final scores.
Stephanie finished with 7. Sarah had 8. I had 12.
All right. Congratulations, Tara.
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 Good job, Tara.
Thank you, Meredith. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We drilled air holes into the bottom of Wanted, the escape of Carlos Ghosn, or, of course, as it should be called, Gone Guy. Before going around the dial, we stopped at The Ultimatum, Sister Wives, 90 Day UK, and Project Greenlight. Tara took a little off Ahsoka's top with her I Am Not a Crackpot hairsertion. Please like me. Please us enough to like it for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Tara said I do to winning this week's Game Time from Meredith. Next up, it's time to return to Archer on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And we're also wrapping up Mako Mania. And then on EHG Prime next week, it's Boss Thunderdome. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
he wasn't very likable.
Sarah D. Bunting.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how elastic is Dave's face?
And Stephanie Early Green.
Backstreet's back.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
I'm so sorry. Was it really bad?
Very bad.
Oh, no. Why'd they do that? I'm so sorry, Evan. I'm so sorry.
It's fine.